Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you this morning, have a chance to speak on the subject of redaction criticism. I'll be speaking on redaction criticism in the Gospels. This is the area I've had the most opportunity to look into. One reason why this subject, I think, is important today is that there has been some considerable debate and argumentation over the validity of redaction criticism and whether it's consistent with the view that the Bible is really God's Word, that it's really inerrant and such. Perhaps this debate has taken its sharpest form in the last couple of years in reaction to a commentary written by Robert H. Gundry, commentary called Matthew, a commentary on his literary and theological art. The problems that developed there, basically, Gundry, evangelical, claims to believe in the inerrancy of Scripture, and yet one of his conclusions in his Gospel of Matthew is that there are a number of places in the Gospel of Matthew where the writer was not intending to write history, but he does not bother to tell us that in his writing. And the result is that we have invented history. Gundry would claim that Matthew is what is called in antiquity, what's called among the Jews, Midrash, and would be most like what we would call a historical novel today. The upshot of all of this was that at the last annual national meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society, Gundry was asked to resign from the society. And he did. The Society's only doctrinal statement is regards the inerrancy of Scripture, and I don't think there's much question that Gundry holds to the inerrancy of Scripture. The real problem was, is there any value in holding to the inerrancy of Scripture if it is hypothetically possible to claim any particular part of Scripture that looks like it's writing history really isn't writing history, it's really writing historical novels. And at least a majority of the members of the society who were present at that meeting felt that those ideas were inconsistent. So Gundry is an example of an important proponent of redaction criticism who would class himself as an evangelical Christian. Well, in our discussion of redaction criticism this morning, we want to start out and ask ourselves, what is redaction criticism? And then say a little bit about how it operates, a little bit about its history, a little bit about its methodology, a little bit about some results. And by then we'll probably have used up our first session, we'll see. And then we'd like to go on and evaluate redaction criticism from a number of perspectives. Well, first of all, what is redaction criticism? Well, you may recognize, if you had any biblical studies, that something criticism is a standard type of term that occurs several places in biblical studies. Higher criticism is a rather general catch-all term for studies about authorship, date, composition, and things of that sort involved in both Old and New Testament studies. Lower criticism, or text criticism, is a study that attempts to get back to the most accurate texts which we have in Scripture. We also have form criticism and literary criticism and redaction criticism and rhetorical criticism. Well, obviously the adjective on the front tells you something about what kind of criticism we're looking at. So we asked ourselves, what is redaction? Well, redaction is the name of what a redactor does, the activity of a redactor. Well, okay, you say. Well, who's a redactor? That's a fairly classy name for editor. So we might call it editorial criticism. The reason perhaps that the term has been used redaction criticism rather than editorial criticism is that most persons who are in this field feel that the editor or redactor is doing a few more things than just modifying an existing text. He's doing some composition on his own. And some people even prefer the term composition criticism rather than the term redaction criticism. A helpful book written from a liberal perspective on redaction criticism is a small volume in the Fortress Press's Guides to Biblical Scholarship. The title is, What is Redaction Criticism? Edited the author Norman Perrin. A couple of places he comes fairly near to giving it definition of redaction criticism, and I've picked out the one he gives on the first page as being probably the most concise statement that he gives. It's not the clearest statement, but it is the most concise one. I'll try to unpack it after I read it for you here. Redaction criticism is concerned with studying the theological motivation of an author, as this is revealed in the collection, arrangement, editing, and modification of traditional material, and in the composition of new material, or the creation of new forms within the tradition of early Christianity. Let's come back and look over that and see if we can figure out what's going on there. Redaction criticism, says Perrin, is concerned with studying the theological motivation of an author. A person's motivation is the reason why he writes something, and his theological motivation is presumably the theological reasons why he writes something. Basically, Perrin is saying, when you study what Luke has done in writing Luke and what Matthew has done in writing Matthew and such, you will begin to see that they have a theological program, and you can figure out what this theological program is. You can figure out what their theology is by figuring out what they collected and how they collected it, how they arranged it, how they edited it, how they modified it, the material that came to them from tradition. So the attempt will be then to figure out all those things. What has been done to the traditional material by Luke or Matthew or even by Mark, and what does this tell us about their theology? And Perrin, at least, and I think Gundry as well, believes that not only did they edit and modify existing material, but at least Matthew, according to Gundry, composed new material. That is, he wrote up material that, in fact, did not exist before his time. Composition of material. Perrin goes on also to talk about the creation of new forms within the tradition of early Christianity. I'm not sure what he has in mind there. Perhaps like Bultmann, he has the idea that some of the gospel writers created miracle stories. That is a form that had not existed in Christian circles and such. I do not know whether that's what he has in mind or not. But that's a little bit of a picture of redaction criticism. An attempt to find out what the theology of various gospel writers are by figuring out what they've done with the material that came to them in the way of either arranging it, editing it, or even creating new material. Well, to see where redaction criticism comes from and how it arises, I think it's helpful to kind of sketch a history of redaction criticism, but we're going to go back pretty far. We're going to go back to the first and second centuries and come all the way down. Redaction criticism has its roots, I suppose, from the very time that the Gospels were written in the first century, as I would understand. But as soon as the four canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, began to circulate, people began to notice that the details in them were not identical, that there were slight differences here and there. And debate and discussion began to develop then on what to make of these things. Already by the second century, opponents of Christianity were claiming that Christianity was obviously false because the Gospels disagreed. One of the writers, Celsus, I believe it is, speaks of Christianity falling on its own sword, so to speak, by having four different Gospels which narrate somewhat different events regarding the life of Christ. One early Christian writer by the name of Tatian was concerned about this matter, and he attempted to take the four Gospels and weave them together into one account, a harmony of the Gospels, not in parallel columns, like our harmonies usually are, but a single narrative in which he had taken the various materials of each Gospel and made sure he didn't leave out any incident, but of course he only gave each incident once and ran it all the way through. His harmony was called the Diatessaron, which is basically just the Greek word for harmony, or Greek word for four-part harmony. That was done, we'll say, somewhere around 160, give or take a few years. Later, at the time of Augustine, that church father, also concerned that opponents were attacking Christianity on divergences among the Gospels, set about to go through all of the Gospels and explain how all of the stories and incidents fit together with one another. And he wrote a work then around 400 AD, called The Harmony of the Evangelists. He went through Matthew and discussed every passage in Matthew that had any parallels in the other Gospels, how they fit together chronologically, how you resolved possible discrepancies, and then he went through the other material as well. These concerns right here show us two important themes, I think, that lead up to redaction criticism. One is what we call the synoptic problem, and the other is a question of the historical reliability of the Gospels. The synoptic problem is a question of how do the Gospels relate to one another, particularly among the three Gospels we call synoptic, that look at things from the same direction, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. There is two rather interesting things going on there. There are, on the one hand, places where you have exact wording, exact order of events and such, in two or three of the Gospels. And then there are other places where you have somewhat unusual things, either a different order of events, or different details, or a divergence in wording on exactly the same material. And so from at least Augustine's time, I think even earlier, persons have wondered on how to fit these things together. Augustine is the earliest person we know of with a theory on how they fit together. And his theory was a theory of successive dependence. Some gospel writer wrote first, and he chose Matthew. And then a second gospel writer came along, and he used Matthew. And a third gospel writer came along, and he used the other two. Augustine's selection for order was Matthew wrote first. Mark took Matthew's gospel and condensed it, kind of a Reader's Digest technique from antiquity. In fact, very common in antiquity. There's a standard term, epitomizer, or an epitome of another work. And that's what he claimed Mark did. And then Luke came along and used both Matthew and Mark. That was Augustine's theory. It was based partially upon the information in the Gospels, partially upon some traditional information regarding the order in which the various Gospels were written. The Roman Empire was already caving in at Augustine's time, and finally collapsed. Well, it's hard to date it exactly. 476 is a traditional date, but it was falling before, and it continued to fall afterwards. The result, in any case, was that very few people after 500 had much leisure to sit around and wonder about the exact relationship of the Gospels and such. So a scholarship in that direction really dies out pretty well from shortly after Augustine's time until all the way up to the Reformation. During the Reformation, however, people begin to make harmonies again. There's a new interest in studying the Bible. People begin to wonder about how these things fit together. And various theories then are constructed on how the Gospels are related to one another. The successive dependence theory of Augustine is revived, and over the course of the next three centuries, up until the last century, every possible order of Matthew, Mark, and Luke is supposed for the order of authorship and the dependence of the Gospels. Matthew writes, Mark uses him, Luke uses both. Matthew writes, Luke uses him, and Mark uses both. And I won't bore you with all the other alternatives with Mark first and then Luke first and such, but you can work them out. I think there are six alternatives. All of those are tried. Then people begin to suggest lost document theories of various sorts. A theory that all three Gospels are operating out of a much larger Gospel that was written in Aramaic. And Matthew picks out certain material and translates into Greek, and Mark picks out about the same material with a few differences and translates it into Greek, and Luke uses the other. This is called the original Gospel, or Ur Evangelium theory, and that was proposed around 1800. other proposals were made that there were lots of little written fragments, little stories, in the gospel that came from Jesus' ministry around, and these were put together by various writers. And so Matthew chose out a selection, Mark chose out a similar selection, Luke chose out a slightly different selection, and John a very different selection. Idea that oral fragments were used, written fragments were used. The oral tradition theory, idea that this material was all oral until Matthew wrote it up. And then Mark used basically oral material, and Luke used basically oral material. The theory which finally came, however, to get the most votes, so to speak, to get the consensus among New Testament scholars, particularly liberals, and to a lesser extent conservatives, was what we now call the two-document theory of the origin of the Gospels. This theory basically claims that Mark is the earliest of the canonical Gospels which was written, but that another work was written also, perhaps about that time or slightly earlier, which was a collection of Jesus' sayings. And some people think Matthew wrote this, some don't, but they don't think it is the Gospel of Matthew. They think it is another source of information about Jesus. And the label it finally wound up with as the common label was Q, a letter which is the abbreviation of the German word for source. And so the idea was then, in your two-document theory, these are the two basic documents. They don't depend upon each other. They depend upon the tradition going back to Jesus' ministry, plus whatever changes may have occurred along the lines. Conservatives would think no important changes, and liberals would think lots of important changes along the line. These two works, then, according to the two-document theory, were used by Matthew's, by the author of Matthew, for conservatives Matthew, for liberals who knows who, and by the author of Luke, which even many liberals would perhaps make to be Luke, and Luke uses Mark and Q, Matthew uses Luke, Mark and Q. This is, then, the form of the synoptic theory, which gained control dominance, if you like, in New Testament studies late in the last century, and although it's been attacked fairly heavily recently, it is still the majority opinion, I would think, even at this time. The idea that the synoptic problem is to be solved by seeing that the similarities between Matthew and Mark and Luke are due to Matthew and Luke using Mark, and the places where Matthew and Luke are similar and Mark doesn't have any of that is due to another document which doesn't exist anymore, a document called, we call, Q. So that basically is what happened there. That is going to lay a groundwork for redaction criticism, as we shall see. A second area very related to it, and which has been going on all the same period of time, is the question of historical reliability of the Gospels. Here, Orthodox Christians throughout history have felt the Gospels are reliable, and most of them felt that the Gospels are inerrant, that God oversaw the Gospels, that he inspired the writing of Scripture in such a way that no statement made about matters of fact would be mistaken. Persons who disagreed with that over church history have usually been those outside the church, persons like Celsus and Porphyry and others who attacked Christianity in their writings. Muslim writers, Muslims regularly have believed that the Gospels have been distorted and messed up and such, and we're very likely to be involved in a great deal more Muslim evangelism or Muslim apologetics in the next generation than we have been so far, so it's not a bad idea to have some knowledge of where they're coming from as well. However, after the period of the Reformation, you have a period in which first in England, there's a rise in deism, and then a rise of rationalism in France, and that carries over into Germany after the French Revolution is finally put down, so to speak, by Napoleon. and this develops into what we call theological liberalism, a movement that considers itself Christian, that considers itself to be members in good standing of the church, and yet within the church they believe that the miracles do not happen, that the information about Jesus in the Gospels is not basically reliable, and therefore the picture of Jesus has to be reconstructed from the reliable material in the Gospels. This led to a whole series of liberal lives of Christ, starting with some Masonic lives of Christ back in the 1700s, the first important one perhaps that of Samuel Ramaris, and then continuing all the way down into our own century. One of the best summaries, surveys of these lives of Christ was written by Albert Schweitzer, The Quest of the Historical Jesus, still available in paperback, written about 1900. And you get a picture of very, very different pictures of Jesus, constructed from the material which each of these writers thought was reliable in the Gospels, and they all disagreed as to just which was reliable. Schweitzer points out, perhaps unkindly, but certainly accurately, that for some reason the Jesuses in all of these lives of Christ always kind of look like the author. they always kind of have his theology and such, unless the person is one who really hates Jesus, in which case you get a rather different picture. However, by the end of the 19th century, the belief among liberals was John was unreliable, Matthew had unreliable material, Mark had unreliable material, Luke had unreliable material, but of the four, Mark was the most reliable. And if you subtracted out the miracles and a few other claims that sounded like they were too much for Jesus, then maybe the rest was really pretty reliable. A German scholar by the name of Wilhelm Vrede, however, threw a monkey wrench into this whole liberal approach with a work of his, The Messianic Secret in the Gospels, written in 1901. He basically argued that the liberals, in reconstructing their lives of Jesus, weren't really getting their information out of the Gospels. They were selecting out of the Gospels what they wanted, but that wasn't enough. And then they filled in all the missing areas, and they got a Jesus who looked like liberal theologians, or maybe at least very pleasant Sunday school teachers. And Vrede wondered how anybody of that sort would likely ever been put to death by the authorities. And Vrede came up with an idea, an extension of liberalism. Instead of saying, well, you guys have abandoned what the Bible tells us about, let's go back and see who he is, Vrede went further off in the direction the liberals had already headed. He argued that the idea that Jesus' messiahship was to be kept secret, which certainly shows up a few places in the Gospel of Mark, was in fact nothing that goes back to Jesus' ministry. It was Mark's way of getting around the serious problem. The problem Mark faced, according to Vrede, was that Jesus never claimed to be the Messiah, but that all his followers, after his death, believed that he was the Messiah. And so Mark tries to solve this theological problem by saying Jesus believed he was Messiah, but he wouldn't let anybody tell when they found out. And so we have a view which we might even call the Sung Yong Moon, a view of messiahship, since a person by that name today wants his disciples to believe he's the Messiah, but he doesn't want to say so himself. And so he encourages his disciples to hint that he's the Messiah, but he never quite says so. Well, Vrede basically claimed a little bit different than that, that Jesus never did think he was the Messiah, but his disciples afterwards believed he was, and in order to cover the fact that he never said so, they claimed there was this messianic secret going on. This is one of the early plot theories, not the first one by any means, one of the early plot theories to explain the life of Jesus, one of the most recent of which has been the Passover plot. And this sort of procedure is rather important in the development of redaction criticism, because for Vrede, much of what is in the Gospel of Mark is Mark's theology and not what really happened in Jesus' life. That is, he tries to distinguish between what Jesus did and said and what Mark added in theologically and what this tells us about Mark's theological views. And Vrede's argument then was that you could not trust the Gospel of Mark for its whole framework about Jesus, and you could not trust the theology of Mark as being the theology of Jesus. Vrede's work, within 20 years, gave rise to a new discipline then, which we call form criticism. What had been going on before, the idea of trying to divide, trying to figure out what gospels borrowed from which gospels and such, is what we call literary criticism. Attempt to reconstruct the literary relationships among the gospels. But Vrede basically claims that Mark invented the chronological framework. Mark invented the theological framework of his gospel. And therefore, when you take that all away, you have a bunch of anecdotes, a bunch of stories without any connectors. And form criticism, then, was an attempt to study these stories and figure out which ones of them went back to Jesus and what the real stories looked like. Form criticism had been around for a while in Old Testament. By the time it got into New Testament, there was a fellow named Gunkel who had been studying the Psalms and Genesis and looking at the stories in Genesis and then trying to explain where they came from and telling us that Genesis stories were often basically attempts to explain the name of some town or the name of some patriarch or something of that variety. And Bultmann at the end, Rudolf Bultmann, at the end of World War I, decided that this method, which Gunkel and others were using in the Old Testament, was the way to get behind the stories of the New Testament and find out what there really was to know about Jesus. So he, independently, independently of him, two other Germans also developed a similar approach, Carl Schmitt and Martin Debailius. All of these rather simultaneously, right at the end of World War I, said, let's go behind the written material and think about the oral tradition in the Gospels. All of them claimed that the Gospels had been, before they were written, the stories about Jesus had been passed from mouth to ear, or mouth to mouth, or however you want to call it, and they had circulated orally, and they were aware that when material circulates orally, it often changes. Perhaps at one party or another, the host has thought of a neat idea and said, let's play the game of gossip. And so they line you up in a circle of chairs. And the first person has a story and he whispers it to the second person. And the second person whispers it to the third and such until you come all the way around the circle. And then the last person tells the story the way you heard it. And that's compared with the first story and everybody has a laugh. And in a sense, a fairly sophisticated sense, Bultmann would claim that this is something of what happened in the generation or two between the ministry of Jesus and the writing of the Gospels, that the stories about Jesus were passed around from preacher to congregation to preacher to congregation, and they got better. Doubtless you've talked to some fishermen who came back and they explained to you that the really big ones got away. And they keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And this is basically the way Bultmann comes at the Gospels. He basically says the stories have developed. They have become more elaborate as time is going on. So the way to figure out what really happened is to restore the forms to their original sets, what they originally were like. And then when we get back to what they were originally like, do they all go back to Jesus? No, Bultmann says. Some of them go back to Jesus, but some of them go back to the early Jewish church, and some of them go back to the early Gentile church. And then he and others worked out techniques, and their technique was like this. If it sounds Jewish, it goes back to the early Jewish church. If it sounds Gentile, it goes back to the early Gentile church. You'd say, well, wait a minute, Jesus is Jewish. Yeah, that's true. Well, then you do it a little better. You say, well, if the theology is the same theology that the Jews held before the rise of Christianity, or the theology which we think that the early Jewish church held, then it must go back to either the Jews or Jewish Christianity. And if the theology is like what we think the early Gentile church held, then it must go back to the early Gentile church. But if it's not like any of those, then it goes back to Jesus. You can guess, I think, that you're not going to wind up with much going back to Jesus with that kind of technique. If we use that method on Luther, we'd have to throw out everything where Luther sounds Lutheran and everything where Luther sounds Roman Catholic, and I think we'd find out that Luther then was a Calvinist, and that would be somewhat of a surprise. even there you can say, oh, that's his Augustinianism showing through. And you really wind up knowing very little about a person with that technique, and yet that is what Bultmann and his followers have tended to do. Well, that is form criticism. We've looked at literary criticism and form criticism. Redaction criticism seeks to kind of fill up the whole picture of explaining how you get the Gospels from the ministry of Jesus to the written forms. Form criticism looks at the oral period from the ministry of Jesus till somebody wrote anything down. Literary criticism looks at the two writings, Mark and Q, which is postulated then who existed, and says something about how they are related to Matthew and Luke. Redaction critics look at two of the stages here. They ask, what did the writer of Mark and Q do in selecting the material they had available to write it up? And what did Matthew and Luke do with Mark and Q when they put together their material? So that basically is what redaction criticism tries to do, to study the work of the editors, especially their theological outlook, in compiling the oral materials to form written accounts, or in combining and editing the written materials to form the present Gospels. This is obviously already foreshadowed in Vreda, who says, look, the writer of Mark took a bunch of stories and made a chronological framework for them, and made a theological framework that Jesus didn't want people to know he was Messiah during his earthly ministry. So in a sense, we could say Vreda is one of our earliest redaction critics. It's also foreshadowed in the work of Bultmann, who, in trying to study the oral forms and such, still has to go back and subtract these materials out of the Gospels in which they occur, and gets into some discussion there. It was also foreshadowed in an English scholar by the name of R.H. Lightfoot, not to be confused with J.B. Lightfoot, the evangelical writer of the last century. Now, this fellow R.H. Lightfoot, writing in the 30s, gave a Bampton lecture in 1934, a lectureship that was originally devoted to the defense of the gospel, but now has, in the last 50 years, generally been a defense of liberalism of some sort or another. not sure Bampton is too enthusiastic about the situation, but he's been gone for 200 years now. In any case, Lightfoot began to move in that direction as well. But again, it was not until right after World War II, and also from Germany, that the real flowering of redaction criticism developed. So kind of a little historical scheme. Form criticism arises from Germany after World War I. Redaction criticism arises from Germany after World War II. Three important works, there have been quite a number of other works done, three important works from right after World War II are an attempt to write a commentary on Matthew, an analysis of Matthew, from the perspective of redaction criticism, the idea that here we can learn about Matthew's theological views by looking at what editorial work he did. That work was originally developed by Günter Bornkamm around 1948 and following in a series of articles, not a full-blown commentary. And he later writes up A Life of Christ. But Bornkamm's work on Matthew, and then, more important probably, the work of Hans Conselman on the Gospel of Luke in 1954. And those basically are saying, look, we have the sources that Matthew and Luke use. We've got Mark, and we can reconstruct Q, and therefore we can tell what editing they're doing. In 1956, Willy Markson tried to go behind that and say something about the redaction criticism done by Mark. And, of course, he could not claim that we had any sources that Mark actually used, since he would have to completely reconstruct those from scratch. But still, he has worked on this whole area of alleged theological motivation, alleged theological tendencies in the Gospel of Mark. Since the time of Bornkamm, Conselman, and Markson, that is late 40s and early 50s, the work has spread to the Gospel of John, attempts to explain how John got his information on the assumption that that we can analyze the sources in one way or another, and to go back and study this alleged document, Q. Q is a document supposed to have existed back in the first couple centuries, which men try to reconstruct from using Matthew and Luke and seeing where they've got material that's not in Mark and where that material is very similar, and then trying to decide which one has got the most original form of it and what it looked like. And that would be examples. Then work has been done in the area of Q, the theology of Q, by Edwards and Totes, Jesus, how's that word, Son of Man, in the Synoptic tradition, which is a study of Q. Well, in recent years, redaction criticism, in a milder form, has spread into and begun to influence many, many evangelicals. Gundry's work on Matthew would be a good sample of this, I would say far the most ambitious sample of this, an attempt to write a commentary on the whole Gospel of Matthew, and a commentary that really comes from that perspective and attempts to see what is going on there. I think Gundry is certainly one of the most radical of the evangelicals who are doing work in this area, but he's certainly not the only evangelical who is doing work and influenced in this way. It does not take much insight to see that a number of evangelicals who are writing works in both Old and New Testament are claiming that the authors worked with previous materials and sometimes modified previous materials in ways to represent something that isn't really historical. And that, I think, is something of the basis of what is going on in redaction criticism. Well, we've looked a little bit at what is redaction criticism just from a definition point of view, and we've looked a little bit at the history of redaction criticism coming up to its development into evangelical circles in recent years. I'd like now to go back and say a little bit about the methodology of redaction criticism. What is a person actually doing when they do redaction criticism? And you should understand here I'm giving the methodology as applied to the Gospels, so those would have to be modified somewhat, although it wouldn't be hard to figure out how it would be modified if you're thinking about what the writer of 1st and 2nd Chronicles would supposedly be doing when he's operating with 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings, something like that. Well, how do you go about doing something like this? Well, the first step would be to take the Gospel you're going to study, if you're studying one particular one, and that would be the usual procedure, and compare it word by word with all the other Gospels, or at least all the other Gospels you have any reason to believe were its sources. If, for instance, like Gundry, you're going to take the Gospel of Matthew to work with, you're going to go through the Gospel of Matthew and mark every single place it differs in any way from the Gospels of Mark and Luke. And you will come down with, of course, thousands of things, some extremely trivial, choice of vocabulary, choice of tense for the verbs, and things of that sort. And other things not so trivial, a question of whether one or two persons were the demoniacs healed by the caves on the hillside on the east side of the Sea of Galilee, the Gadarene demoniac or Gerasene demoniac. And basically then one is going to wind up with a huge amount of information to be processed. All of these differences. Now the second step is taking all of these differences to try and figure out which of those differences are the result of the editorial activity of the particular writer you're studying. So, assuming again we're studying Matthew, you say, okay, here we've got, I don't know how many, 500, 2,000, something like that, differences, some very trivial, some more significant. And the question then is, which of these are due to Matthew's editorial activity and which are not? Here we get into one of the very significant features of redaction criticism. To do anything at this point, you've got to make an assumption about who copied from who used who. And Gundry follows most persons who are doing work in this area. They take the two-document theory for the origin of the Gospels. Mark has been used by Matthew, and Q has been used by Matthew. Well, Mark you've got. So you compare Mark with Matthew, and any of the differences are due to Matthew's editorial activity. Q was used by Matthew. But what do you do about that? Q doesn't exist. I'd say Q never existed, but we'll get back to that later. What you do is you take Matthew and Luke, and you find out where they've got material in common that isn't in Mark, and that is supposed to come from Q, plus, presumably, some material in Matthew that Matthew used out of Q, but Luke didn't, and some material in Luke, which Luke used out of Q, but Matthew didn't. And there's been lots of argument for the last century on how much of that there is. If you get a lot of it, you wind up with a big gospel for Q. If you have very little of it, you wind up with a whole series of sayings in Q and nothing else, a saying source of some kind. So, to be able to make any attempt to figure out what of the details that separate Matthew from Mark and Luke are due to Matthew's editorial activity, you've got to assume that Matthew has used Mark, and that Matthew has used Q, and that you can somehow figure out what a more original form of Q is. There's a fairly strong tendency to see Luke as the more original form of Q than Matthew, which of course then is very handy for someone like Gundry, because then any of the differences between Luke and Matthew, he can say this is Matthew's editorial activity. A second assumption has to be made on this stage. When you're attempting to discover which of these differences are the result of the editorial activity of, say, Matthew. Okay, you've got these two sources back there. Did Matthew have any other sources? Gundry, surprisingly, says no. That is rather surprising when you think that that Gundry does, in fact, come down with Matthew as being the apostle and who must have seen Jesus and heard Jesus for several years. Gundry surprisingly comes down with the answer no. There are lots of liberals that don't come down with the answer no. B.H. Streeter had Matthew using a third source, and he wasn't sure exactly how big it was, but he felt that you couldn't assign all of the rest of Matthew that's not Mark or Luke to Q or to Matthew's own invention, but Gundry assumes that there are no other sources. That, of course, is not necessary to redaction criticism. Redaction criticism, a person would say, well, I don't know what's the origin of this other material that doesn't come from Mark and I can't find in Q. A person might say, well, let's see if we can figure out from the material that Matthew's used out of Mark and what he's done to it, and the material that Matthew's used out of Q and what he's done to it, let's see if we can figure out what Matthew's style is. In fact, Gundry does do some of this, and a number of other persons work in this direction. Let's figure out what his style is. Let's figure out what his favorite words are. Let's figure out how he tends to use the verb tenses and how he tends to use conjunctions and such. And then when we've got this material we can't tell which is his, let's see where we can find out his style shows up, and then we'll assign that to Matthew. Something of that sort, then, would be done to try and figure out what is going on in this area. So we carefully compare all the differences between Matthew, let's say, and its parallel Gospels, Mark, Luke. We attempt to figure out which of these differences are the results of the editorial activity of, say, Matthew in this case. Compile some statistics then on his style as a result of that to fill in those questions where things might be uncertain. And now we finally get to what redaction criticism is all about, according to Perrin, and that is we study those differences which are the author's editorial activity and try and figure out what his theological motivation was for doing these things in writing up his gospel. So you go through all of this, you have these differences. Out of this huge set of differences, you extract a smaller set that are particularly Matthew's editorial activity, and then you go through and see what the theological differences appear to be between what he had in Matthew or what he had in Mark or what he had in Q and what he's written, and you try and figure out what his theology is that's going on there.
Please turn the cassette over at this point.
Conselman would go further than this, then, and having found these theological things, he would now go and look throughout the gospel, he was working with Luke, and find out if the writer actually expresses these theologies in the particular verses in the gospel. Don't recall that Gundry does that particularly, but that would be the procedure to do there. Now, the last step, then, is having found these theological emphases, these theological differences and such, to now go back and interpret the whole gospel in the light of this theological motivation. So you start out with the differences, you take a subset of the differences that represent those which you think are the writer's editorial activity, you try and figure out what theological motivation might be at work to make those changes, and then you see if the writer expresses that theological emphasis anywhere. That, of course, wouldn't be necessary, but that would presumably be a check of some variety that he had that theological view. And then you would finally come back and you would say, okay, now I'm going to interpret the whole gospel in terms of these theological motivations. Having done that, there's one other thing you can do. That gives you material for commentary then. You can then go through and say, this is Matthew's program. This is what he's interested in. This is how he does it here, 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 etc. There's one other thing you can do. You can reconstruct the author's theology from what you've done. And you wind up with Matthew having a certain outlook on things, and Luke another, and Mark another. You can also try and figure out what the writer's circumstances are. When was he writing? What kind of problems were going on? When? They might not be able to come up with any kind of a real date. What group did he belong to? What was their theology and such? And what audience is he writing for? And these things are done. Gundry does a fair bit of this, and a number of these other writers do as well. You actually wind up with two or more Sitzenlebens. Sitzenimleben, I guess, is a more accurate way of saying it. We haven't used that term yet. That's a term that arose in form criticism. It's a German word that just means life setting. And basically, it is an attempt to reconstruct under what circumstances some story about Jesus might have been used, what situation it might have been told in. And in redaction criticism, you wind up with actually two or three life settings that you have to think about if you're going to do biblical interpretation from a redaction critical perspective. All of us who are interested in studying the Bible and studying the Gospels are, of course, interested in what is the life setting in Jesus' ministry for various passages we're interpreting. Why did Jesus say this particular sentence? You can often figure out by studying the context and seeing what audience he was speaking to and what had just happened. He had just fed the 5,000. And so is speaking about the true bread that comes down from heaven, is warning the audience that they shouldn't be so concerned about bread, they should be concerned about spiritual life and such. Well, that would be the setting in the life of Jesus. But if one is doing redaction criticism on Matthew or Luke, that's not the only question you would have. You would also have the question of, what is the life setting of the guy who wrote Mark or the guy who wrote Q? Why did he take this incident out of Jesus' ministry and record it? And what did he do to it in recording it? How did he modify it to agree with the concerns that he had? So then one would get into a study of Mark's theology and what Mark's setting and what was going on then and the theology of Q and who that was written to and what kind of person it was written by and such. And so that would be a second Sitzenleben. Sitzenleben or life setting in the life of Jesus or the ministry of Jesus. The life setting in the community to which Q is writing or to which Mark is writing. And if you're doing redaction criticism of Mark or Q, that's all you've got. You've got the setting and life of the ministry of Jesus, presuming the event ever occurred in the ministry of Jesus, and you've got the setting and life in the community from which this writer is writing or to which this writer is writing. But if you're doing redaction criticism with Matthew or Luke, you've got three of them, because Matthew and Luke, according to this approach, are using Mark and Q. And Mark and Q are recording information from Jesus' ministry. So then you've got the setting and life of Jesus' ministry, and you've got the setting and life of the writer Mark or Q, depending on which one you decide it is at a given point, and you've got the setting and life of Matthew. What was he writing? Why was he writing the thing he wrote? And who was he writing it to? And what were the circumstances and such? The result is that one may get into a long discussions and draw all sorts of conclusions about the alleged historical circumstances of the writer of the Gospel of Matthew, or about his audience and such, but you're getting all this indirectly from differences between Matthew and Mark on the assumption that Matthew has used Mark, and differences between Matthew and Q on the assumption that there is a Q and that Matthew has used Q. And what one is going to do with that will differ somewhat depending on how conservative or how liberal one's theological views are. Let's turn then from the methodology of redaction criticism, maybe I should review that quickly for you, to the results of redaction criticism. Methodology again, quickly. Carefully compare all the differences between a particular gospel you're studying and its parallels. Two, attempt to discover those differences, which are the result of the editorial activity of the writer that you're studying. And to do that, you've got to make these assumptions I mentioned. You've got to assume you know what sources he used and how many and what he did to them. Where you assume you know what sources he used, you can tell what he did to them. But then you study these detailed differences to determine the author's theological motivation for introducing these differences. And then you interpret the whole gospel in terms of these motivation. And finally, you reconstruct the author's outlook, his circumstances, his group, his audience from this materials. And then when you wind up doing exegesis of any gospel passage, you've got to ask yourself, what is the Sitzen Leben of this in the community Matthew is writing to? What is the Sitzen Leben of this in the community that his source was writing to? And what is the Sitzen Leben of this of the actual event, if indeed it occurred? Some results of redaction criticism. Liberals, not surprisingly, would conclude from this sort of material, we know very, very little about the life of Jesus. Would not be surprised about that, I would think, that it's passed through an oral period, and the people apparently had no great qualms, according to liberalism, of inventing a fair amount of material, and then that material was selected by persons with very diverse theological motivations, and they wrote it up. And then that material was selected and edited by other persons with diverse theological motivation, and they wrote it up. And so you wind up with a result that one can know very, very little about Jesus. But you can reconstruct, we should say, lots of very diverse theological groups in early Christianity. And in fact, that is a feature that is very important in liberal gospel studies, trying to figure out who Matthew's circle was, and who Luke's circle was, and what other kind of theological groups were out there, who wrote the Gospel of Thomas, and such. And the idea that there's all of these heresies out there in early Christianity, but none of them are really heresies, because you really wind up that none of them were really telling us much about who Jesus really was. That is a very much a characteristic of liberal theological work, particularly liberal theological work as done in the universities, as opposed to that done in the seminaries. I think it's helpful in understanding what's going on out in the world around us, in the theological world around us, to make a distinction between two kinds of liberalism. They overlap rather substantially, but they're still different. What we might call denominational liberalism, and what we might call secular liberalism, or university liberalism. Denominational liberals, the guys who teach Old Testament, New Testament theology and such at liberal theological seminaries, have to retain their jobs. And there's a board over them of some sort. And that board is not probably particularly conservative, but that board is responsible to some denomination. And that denomination is probably not particularly conservative either, but there's some conservatives in that denomination, and they pay their tithes to help run all of this stuff. And if they ever got wind of what some of these people were doing with Jesus, they'd kick them out or leave the denomination. And so on the pastoral level, you're going to find in liberal theological circles a great concern not to rock the boat if you're liberal, or if you're aware that there are both liberals and conservatives in your group. However, if a person, a naive person from one of those groups, decides to go to his denominational college or seminary, he will begin to find out what they really believe when he gets into the classes in this material. And yet still, persons who teach in those areas might be asked whether they believe in God, and it certainly wouldn't do for them to write in books that God doesn't exist. By and large, the people who teach in the seminaries and colleges in liberal denominations are nice liberals. They kind of like Jesus, and they think he was a great guy, and we ought to really mold our religion around some ideas that he had and such. But they don't really believe he did all the things the Bible says about him. And if he rose from the dead, it was only spiritual. Some of them might even be able to give a little break for a miracle in that spot somewhere. That's about it. Outside the denominations, however, you're talking about who chairs university positions in New Testament, Old Testament theology and such. There are no such constraints. Go where the facts are. That's what they want to do in the universities. And their claim would be, well, we're not fettered by denominational controls. They may be fettered by other controls of who they'll give doctorates to and such that guarantee you produce some kind of a rather secular liberal. But in any case, there's a real difference there. The result is that your university liberal professors have a tendency to be more radical than your denominational or seminary liberal professors do, but neither of them could ever be mistaken for a fundamentalist. So we should not be surprised in that direction. The result is in liberal circles, redaction criticism is a standard new tool, and the result is that you find out mostly about early theological groups by looking at the Gospels and very little about Jesus. Come back to a sample or two of that when we discuss the evaluation of redaction criticism. conservative circles, redaction criticism has come in also, but here it is much more restrained. However, with the work of Guthrie and some others, but Guthrie I think would be on the near the radical extreme, at least of anything in print, from evangelical circles, you find that already redaction critical work in evangelical circles is beginning to introduce the idea that not all of the gospel narrative describes events which really happened. And there I think we begin to get into some very, very serious problems. For Gundry, the Gospel of Matthew is by the Apostle Matthew. Jesus really did most of the things that occur in the Gospel. Jesus really worked miracles. Jesus really rose from the dead. So he's certainly conservative, and I would say evangelical. But Jesus didn't do all the things that the Gospel of Matthew says he did. For Gundry, the Gospel of Matthew is a midrash. That is a Jewish word. And he is certainly accurate in saying that the Gospel of Matthew has a Jewish cast to it. So he looks around in Jewish circles for the kind of writing that you could find that invents stories about biblical characters. And there is such a material, and that we usually call it midrash. That is a type of literature that you can find in the Talmud, whether it be the Jerusalem or the Babylonian Talmud. You can find in the commentaries on the Old Testament, which by the way have the name midrashim, midrashes. And in these you'll often find stories about biblical characters that we have no information about in Scripture. In the Bible, we find out that Abraham was some fellow whom God chose out of the pagan society of Ur, the Chaldees, and called him to go off somewhere. But in Jewish material, you find out that God had a good reason for choosing this fellow. This fellow really didn't like paganism, and he really had come to the conclusion there was only one God. And so he was really kind of better than the other guys, and so that's why God chose him. And Jacob, although he really does not look much better than Esau, one might even argue in some ways worse than Esau in the Bible, in Jewish retellings of the Bible, he always looks better than Esau. And you remember how Jacob lied to his father that he was Esau in order to get the birthright and such. But in Jewish Midrashim, Isaac asks, "Are you my son Esau?" And Jacob says, "I am your son." Half a lie, okay? But look at the Bible, it's a full lie. this technique, which developed in Jewish circles, we do not know the reasoning behind. We unfortunately do not have any of these guys around to interview to know why they're doing what they're doing. I can guess, Gundry can guess why they're doing what they're doing, but we really don't know the answer. I don't know the answer whether the writers of this Midrashim really thought these things happened, or guessed that maybe something like this happened, or whether they knew it didn't happen, but they invented the stories because they knew that if you're going to follow the example of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, etc., you want to make the guys look pretty good, so you follow good examples. I don't know the answer to that, of why they did what they did, but we do see in a number of Jewish writings from intertestament period, Book of Jubilees is probably one of the big examples, and from the later rabbinic writings, retellings of the biblical material that make the patriarch, the good guys, look better and the bad guys look worse, and various other matters of that sort. Gundry claims that Matthew is a midrash. Matthew has invented a number of stories about Jesus to make theological points, but in fact, the events never happened. We'll look at a couple of examples of these in a bit here, but let me just mention the two most striking ones for you, because these occur at the beginning of Matthew's commentary, and it's one of the reasons why it created such a sensation. According to Gundry, Matthew had no sources available to himself but Mark and Q. But as soon as you begin to look at the birth account in Matthew, you notice some rather strange things. Matthew has got lots of stuff that we don't see in Mark about the wise men and Herod and the slaying of the innocents and the flight to Egypt and all of that sort of thing. And it's not Luke either. Gundry says, aha, it is in Luke. It's just you don't recognize what Matthew's redaction is all about. Say, wait a minute. Three wise men, you converted them into Gentile wise men. Good night. You have to read his discussion. We'll look at it a little bit further on here in evaluation, however. What about Herod's killing the innocents? Well, that's in Luke 2. Where? Well, when Mary and Joseph go up to the temple and kill the two turtledoves. That's been modified by Matthew into the slaying of the children. And what about the flight to Egypt? Well, that's when Joseph and Mary go up to the temple and go up to Galilee. Matthew has modified that into the couple taking Jesus down to Egypt and back up. And he would say, Matthew has done these things not to mislead his audience. He has done these things to make certain theological points. One of the points he would claim Matthew is making is that Matthew wants to show us that Jesus is the Messiah, the Savior, the Gentiles as well. So he has some Gentiles visit him while he is a baby. And Jesus wants to parallel, Matthew wants to parallel Jesus' life with that of Israel, the nation Israel. And so just as Israel goes down into Egypt for protection and comes back into the promised land and is tempted in the wilderness, etc., 40 years, so Jesus goes down into Egypt for protection and comes back to the promised land and is tempted in the wilderness 40 days. And so you get a rather elaborate set of developments here in Gundry. The most elaborate ones are, in fact, right at the beginning, because it is the material in Matthew's birth narratives that is not paralleled in any obvious way in Luke and does not show up in Mark. Gundry points out that he's sorry that the commentary has to begin that way. He would rather you read most of the commentary and see how good a technique he's got before you get to stuff like this. But because commentaries start with the beginning of the gospel and go to the end, he's pretty well stuck with putting that up front. Well, I've covered my material up until we start an evaluation of redaction criticism, and I think we'll stop right there, and I'll entertain a few questions if you want to ask me some. I'm not any great scholar in this area, so there may be lots of I don't knows, but I'll make an attempt to answer any question if I can. Yes, sir, back there in the yellow shirt. The question there basically is about Old Testament work. The JDP theory relates to an alleged four document sources behind the first five books of the Old Testament, and elaborate theory has been worked up since the time of Wellhausen in the 1870s, and with stylistic differences and all of that. I have not seen the details on that. My area is not Old Testament, but my impression is that the computers have not given them the backing they would have liked in that particular area. It would seem to me that indeed there is some stylistic difference between the material that they would assign to P and the material that they would assign to J and E and the material they would assign to D. It seems to me you can find three styles in the Pentateuch, but you're looking at three different kinds of material in the Pentateuch. The material they assign to P is almost invariably what we would call statistics, tabular material, stuff we would put in tables in a book or as a chart in a book or something of that sort, but that wasn't the technique in antiquity, so they wrote it all out. So you get genealogies and a description of how to build the tabernacle and that sort of thing. Whereas the materially assigned to D is almost entirely Deuteronomy, and it's a sermon. It's a person addressing a congregation, explaining to them their duties and responsibilities. Well, the kind of material, the kind of style that you have when you are making genealogies and describing the building of a building is a rather different style than you would have if you're giving a sermon. If your sermons sound like genealogies and building plans, you will not be in the pastorate very long. Okay? And if your genealogies and building plans are very homiletical, your building will collapse around your ears. So there are some really different styles there. The J and E have identical styles, or at least nearly identical styles, according to even most critics themselves. And the reason for that, I think, is that they're the narrative material. And what you really find in the Pentateuch is a narrative style, a tabular style, and a homiletic style. And there's no reason why one person who wishes to narrate, to exhort, and to explain detail won't use three rather different styles. So I would say certainly for J and E, I would be quite surprised if the computer could detect any stylistic differences. I'm not sure about the other areas there, so can't back you up on that. That kind of problem, I think, is a problem that lies behind redaction criticism. We'll say a word or two about it when we get into our discussion of evaluating that. Further questions?
Yeah,
I would take it to be somewhat on the boundary, and certainly it's the sort of thing which one could do, and one thing which would not certainly have to get you into trouble with inerrancy or things like that. I'm not totally satisfied with everything Lane does in his commentary. I have read it through. I haven't read it through recently enough to have a good feel whether I would characterize it as redaction criticism, but certainly an attempt to reconstruct the circumstances of the author and his recipients is a reasonable sort of thing to do. I will suggest when we get to our evaluation here that people do it with a great deal more confidence than they ought to, I think. But we'll come back to that. But I think that is something that's related to redaction criticism. And what I want to do when we evaluate redaction criticism next hour is say there are a few favorable things that can be said about it, and then get into some very serious problems. So certainly an attempt to reconstruct the author's circumstance is good, as long as you don't believe your reconstructions too much. And there you can get into some problems. Lane at least would have the advantage there that we have some traditional information that would suggest that that was about the time that Mark was writing. Whether it was after the persecution started or not is another question, however. Okay, further questions? Well, you don't have to read too many books on Old and New Testament criticism to find that scholars will do lots of things with hypothetical documents. I'm going to, in my evaluation, discuss a couple of fallacies, which I have names for, the explanation fallacy, the sand foundation fallacy, and the dissertation fallacy, and they all relate to your question, so maybe I'll put it off until we get there. The question of building upon what is only hypothesis, and then thinking that one has very good results because lots of other scholars agree with you, though in fact you've got no real independent evidence from the period in which these things went on. That, I think, is a serious problem. And I don't know what to tell you about it. It's a disease that occurs to scholars, and one which we need to be careful about, even though we need to be able to gain that which scholars are doing that is really valuable. That's a really difficult problem. Yes, sir? There's some argument about who started using the idea, but H.J. Holtzman in the 1870s, was certainly using it. I believe there was somebody made a suggestion of it earlier than that, but it slips my mind now whether it was Lockman or Schleiermacher, it's not Schleiermacher. There's somebody even earlier, but he's not usually given credit for it because he didn't work it out in detail. H.J. Holtzman and Bernard Weiss are the two earliest ones, one in the 70s and one in the 80s, I believe. It's really based on the assumption that Matthew and Luke use Mark. So then you take all the stuff that looks like Mark out of Matthew and Luke, and you've got a lot left. And a lot of what you've got left in Matthew and Luke looks a lot like each other. And you could say, well, Luke used Matthew, okay, or Matthew used Luke. But the proposal was both of them used a third source, used another source, source Q, okay. So the name is agreed to be hypothetical. Some people have claimed that there's a reference to it in one of the early church fathers, a fellow named Papias, who, however, says Matthew composed the oracles in the Hebrew or Aramaic language, and so it's hard to tell which he says, and everyone interpreted them as he was able. And a number of persons have claimed that is not Papias talking about Matthew's gospel, that's Papias talking about Q. And a number of these liberals will even say Matthew wrote Q. Okay, so that's the kind of thing that's going on. In fact, there was a long time in the early part of the century where writers were referring to Q as the logia, the very word that Papias uses for the oracles. That's the Greek word for oracles, logia. But that has now been dropped because most people feel that there's not enough evidence that that's what Papias was talking about. We better quit, I guess. Our time's just about up here.
This series is concluded on the next cassette. For a free catalog of cassettes and literature available from the Interdisciplinary Biblical Research Institute, please write to IBRI, IBRI, Box 423, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.